Rumpole and Hilda by John Mortimer, adapted by Richard Stoneman, starring Julian Rhine-Tutt as Horace Rumpole.
This is a story that Rumpole will never tell. It's not at all how he would wish to present himself in the many accounts he has written of his brilliance down the Old Bailey. In court, Rumpole likes to act the part of an inadequately paid and outspoken rebel against authority, with his grey wig askew and his gown a little tattered. At home, Rumpole acts the part of a free spirit, imprisoned through no fault of his own in marriage. And yet, in the story I'm about to tell, it was not Rumpole who found himself with a chance to escape from that wedlock.
But for heaven's sake, switch off that fire, Rumpole. You could roast a chicken in here. Oh, let's have some fresh air, shall we?
Oh, you planning to freeze me to death before I can pull off what promises to be one of my most sensational defences?
If you're cold, wear a cardigan.
Harvey Skelton is going to outdo the fame of all my previous triumphs.
Well, that shouldn't be difficult. Oh, I need a gin and tonic. Do you want a glass of something?
No.
Oh. I see you have a bottle already. Nearly finished?
Doing my best. Some of these photographs. Quite shocking, Hilda. My client's charged with beating his father to death using a golf club. Look.
I don't want to look.
This is the father, Dmitry Skelton. Some Russian blood in the family, I think. Certainly a lot of blood on the carpet. Dmitry was a very successful private surgeon. The son, Michael, my client, is an undergraduate at King's College London.
Oh.
Yeah, so a bright boy. But a bright boy with a lot of evidence against him.
Ah.
Luckily for Michael, I shall be handling the case alone and without a leader.
Is that because all the leaders realise that Michael Skelton has got too much evidence against him?
No, it's because my instructing solicitor knows that I am a far greater defender than all those self-important amateurs who wrap themselves in silk gowns and flaunt the initials QC after their names.
And who is the dodgy lawyer who's handed you this poison chalice? Bonnie Bernard, as usual?
No. No, my instructing solicitor for this particular case just happens to be Daniel Newcombe.
Who?
Of Newcombe, Pouncewort and Delaney. The grandest firm dealing in criminal matters in the whole of Greater London. Daniel is the senior partner, and I believe, with me in command, his firm may pull off something quite sensational.
You mean get a boy off who murdered his father?
Who is alleged to have murdered his father. Young Michael is as innocent as you are until he's proved guilty.
I wonder if your own son would ever beat you to death with a golf club. If Nicholas did something like that, would you try to prove that he was not guilty?
I'd be dead, Hilda, so I wouldn't really be in a position to defend my own son, who fell asleep an hour ago, in case you were wondering.
I hope you read him a bedtime story and not some grisly pathologist report.
As if I would. By the way, Daniel Newcombe has invited me to dine with him at the Sheridan Club next Thursday. He said he wanted to get to know me better.
Well, then he should talk to me. At least you'd get an unbiased opinion.
Oh, you're coming too.
He's invited me.
Do bring your lovely wife, he said. I assume he meant you.
But, Rumpole, you hate going to dinner at the Sheridan Club. You say it's full of pompous balls.
We all have to make sacrifices if we're to rise to the top in the legal profession. And, for the sake of a brief from Newcombe, Pouncewort and Delaney, I would willingly rent a dog collar and go to dinner with the Archbishop of Canterbury. My God, there's a wind whistling round my knees that must have come straight from the Ural Mountains.
Your feet! Cold. Go and put on some warm clothing.
Why don't you go and...
And what?
And
Rumpole.
And fetch me some warm clothing, Hilda. Please.
On the following Thursday evening, as soon as Daniel Newcombe waved to us from the other side of the Sheridan's dining room, I felt peculiar.
I'm sorry to drag you to my club, which I'm afraid you'll find desperately dull, Hilda. More chablis?
Oh, thank you. These potted shrimps are delicious, by the way.
You say you're not a member, Horace? I find that hard to believe.
It's true. Not a member.
Were you blackballed?
Certainly not. Never wanted to join.
Is that white burgundy all right for you, Horace?
Mm. Well, since you're asking, I'd rather have a slurp of the red, or a couple of slurps, if it's possible.
I was so embarrassed. More so when Rumpole started to talk about the case.
From the police photographs, it's obvious there'd been a hell of a fight in the hall. The grandfather clock was knocked over and stopped at 10:45. You noticed that, Daniel?
Horace, please. We didn't come here to talk shop.
As Daniel put a hand on Rumpole's sleeve, I noticed how clean and well manicured his fingernails were.
We came here to get to know each other. There are some pretty dusty old members here, Hilda. But we do have some rather fine paintings if you look around the walls. Mm.
We inspected the portraits in the dining room.
Oh, yes.
And I admired Daniel's distinguished profile. He'd spoken briefly about his estranged wife, Diana.
Oh, lovely.
And how lonely he found it in his empty flat in Chelsea.
It's really rather magnificent.
I had to fight a curious impulse to put my arm around his shoulder to cheer him up. But of course I couldn't do that. Not in the Sheridan Club. With Rumpole sitting beside me, slurping his claret.
Over there is a portrait of the beautiful Elizabeth Linley, whom Sheridan loved. Don't you think, Horace, that she has a distinct look of Hilda about her?
No.
Lying in bed that night, trying to focus on my crossword puzzle, I was thinking about Daniel's well-cut tweed suit, the highly polished brogues, the silk handkerchief in his breast pocket, and a slight whiff of a very masculine eau de cologne. Until Rumpole interrupted.
Blood, Hilda!
Oh, what?
Blood.
Where?
You know why Michael Skelton didn't want to be a doctor like his father?
Oh, well, I'm sure you're going to tell me.
Michael couldn't bear the sight of blood. And yet the hallway was covered in the stuff after his father was beaten to death. Splashes on the walls, pictures, everything in sight. Look at this photograph.
No! I don't want nightmares.
How should a boy who couldn't stand the sight of blood commit a murder? Surely the last thing he'd choose is to bash his father round the head with a golf club until his brains were all over the floors and walls, as seen in this photograph.
I said I didn't want to look. Rage, Rumpole, rage can drive people to forget their squeamishness. If you're suitably annoyed with someone, you could happily kill them using any method at your disposal. Now turn off the light and go to sleep.
Shortbread.
What happened next was, I admit, a foolish mistake on my part.
Mm. What luck you were free for luncheon, Hilda.
It wasn't luck. I'm nearly always free for luncheon and dinner.
Your husband's in court, I believe.
Would you rather he were here?
Oh, absolutely not. More wine?
Thank you, Daniel.
Please. It's Danny. At least, that's what my special friends call me.
Oh, well, Danny, then. Rumpole's quite impossible at the moment. Full of himself, because you decided to let him do the Skelton case alone and without a leader.
I didn't want the jury to think Michael's a poor little rich boy. If I had a top QC, they'd say, oh, that's what he does with his father's money. Your husband, with his rather shabby gown, might make the good citizens of East Sussex feel quite sorry for the lad.
Oh, is that the reason? I'd better not tell Rumpole.
More tactful, perhaps, if we make this our little secret.
Yes, our little secret, Danny. Rumpole seems to have found a defence.
Good for him. I've been racking my brains.
Apparently, Dimitri Skelton was desperate for Michael to become a surgeon. Quite natural for a father to want his son to follow in his footsteps. Oh, I imagine Rumpole will encourage our little boy, Nicholas, to become an Old Bailey hack.
I'm sure he'll do much better than that.
Oh, I hope so. But he's only five, so who knows?
Five? Oh, you looked far too young.
Oh, please, don't be silly. It seems that Michael Skelton almost fainted at the sight of blood.
What? Oh, yes, he told me.
So Rumpole will ask, how could he have committed such a blood-stained murder?
Hmm. I suppose money overcomes a lot of finer feelings. Dimitri died a very wealthy man, nearly £200,000 to his name. And Michael was the sole heir. He stood to gain a huge amount of cash from his father's death. That's the big hurdle Rumpole's got to get over. I don't envy him that. However much I envy him other things.
I can't imagine what other things you mean.
Your companionship, Hilda.
Oh.
Sometimes I long for a complete change in my life.
I'm sure we all do.
I'd love to give up the legal treadmill, go away to the sunshine. Perhaps with a new companion, Hilda. Tis not too late to seek a newer world. Push off, and sitting well in order, smite the sounding furrows.
Underneath these granite crosses, no one counts their gains and losses, but they whisper underground all the answers they have found.
Oh, what's that, Rumpole?
A poem that will never make it into the Oxford Book of English Verse.
Well, at least it rhymes. Who wrote it?
My client, Michael Skelton. It's called In a Sussex Graveyard.
Oh, your client's a poet?
Well, he wants to be. I saw him today, in a Sussex prison. Strange young man. He hardly bothered to answer my questions. He didn't seem nervous or frightened or even especially concerned about the case.
He probably killed the poor man for his money.
Hilda, have you accepted a brief for the prosecution?
I'm just saying. Michael Skelton was his father's sole heir, and I'm sure the private surgery brought him quite a lot of cash, so...
How do you know Michael's the sole heir?
Oh, I must have read it in the Daily Telegraph.
Well, it's not quite true. What's that copy of the will? I saw it, I saw it. Now, here. Right. Yes, Skelton Sr. left £10,000 to his secretary, an attractive girl, according to Michael, and all the rest and residue of my estate to my son, Michael Skelton, or if he should predecease me, to my cousin, Ivan Skelton, now resident in Sydney, Australia.
Well, Michael didn't predecease him, did he? Otherwise you wouldn't be defending him.
Oh, Hilda, what a wonderful grasp of legal principles you have.
Please don't patronise me, Rumpole. Just tell me what kind of defence you've got.
Really?
Yes.
Then look at this photograph.
No, I...
Don't worry, it's just the grandfather clock. Oh. Stopped at 10:45. I told you that was important.
Why?
Michael has got an alibi for 10:45.
What sort of alibi?
He was composing that poem that I read you, walking around in the beech woods, about half a mile from his father's house. There were people there who saw him, witnesses.
In a wood at 10:45, what sort of witnesses would have seen him there?
Gypsies. They've moved on now, but according to Michael, they were camping there that night, and he stopped to talk to them by their bonfire. He even read them a bit of the poem. I'm sure they were hugely impressed.
And have you found the gypsies?
Not yet, but after our visit to see Michael in prison, old Turnbull took me for a walk round the Skelton's house and through the beechwoods.
Who's old Turnbull?
My, Hilda, you are full of questions.
Oh, I'm just trying to get things clear in my head. Don't you want me to take an interest in your case?
Of course. Daniel Newcombe has an ancient clerk called Turnbull. I don't know his first name, in case you're about to ask.
I wasn't. And did you find anything of interest?
Just some tire tracks, the remains of a campfire, quite a lot of litter.
Talking of Daniel Newcombe, perhaps I ought to tell you, we had lunch together. It was Daniel's idea.
Why on earth did Newcombe want lunch with you?
I think he's taken a bit of a shine to me.
Well, I just hope he can find those missing gypsies.
Oh, Rumpole.
I'm getting Newcombe to advertise in the East Sussex Gazette. Anyone seen a young man reading poetry at 10:45 on the night of the 12th of May? It might help us, I suppose. Skelton's fixed for the 4th of next month. Daniel Newcombe's attending the trial in person. He'll be staying in the same hotel. It's a pity. I don't want to spend every dinner time getting unhelpful advice from my instructing solicitor.
Can I come too?
To Lewis? To the Old Bear Hotel?
Yes, please.
Why on earth would you want to do something like that?
Because... It's a long time since I've seen you in action, Rumpole. A long time since I've seen you in court.
You really want to watch me in action? And stay with me? In a hotel?
I think it might be quite nice. It is not too late to seek a newer world. We are not now that strength which in old days move earth and heaven.
That which we are, one equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield.
And not to yield. Not quite sure about that. As Rumpole took his seat in court number 2 of the East Sussex Assizes, I could recognise a man in his element. One of his many nemeses, Mr. Justice Graves, was presiding. Claude Erskine Brown, prosecuting, opened proceedings by describing the horror of the crime. In the dock, young Michael Skelton was small, dark, pale and neat, looking like a schoolboy at a prize-giving, and nothing like a murderer. I sat with the solicitors, next to Danny Newcombe. The court was so full we had to sit close together. And from time to time, when he moved to look for a statement, his arm brushed mine. First came the evidence from Mr. and Mrs. Beasley, who worked for Skelton and lived in a cottage about 50 yards from the back door of Skelton's house. Mrs. Beasley was the cook-come-housekeeper. Mr. Beasley, short and weaselish, was the driver-come-handyman.
And you and your wife were inside your cottage watching a war film, Mr. Beasley?
She loves a good war film, my wife. It was The Guns of Navarone, starring David Niven and Gregory Peck. The guns were firing and the grenades were exploding at a very loud volume.
Until what time, exactly?
I think the film finished at 11 o'clock, and then I heard someone calling for help from the house. I ran over, found young Michael standing in the hallway with a golf club. There was blood everywhere. And then I saw Mr. Skelton on the floor.
Was he still alive?
Didn't look like it. Not with his brains oozing out of his head like that.
Thank you, Mr. Beasley. Will you wait there in case my learned friend has any questions?
How long did it take you to get into the hallway from the moment you heard the cry for help?
Just a few seconds, sir.
And when you first saw Mr. Skelton Sr., he appeared to be dead. So it's unlikely it was he who called out for help just a few seconds before. But it might well have been my client, young Michael Skelton, whose voice you heard.
It might have been.
Calling for help for the man he's accused of murdering. Is that your evidence?
Well, I suppose...
Or perhaps the young man was calling for help because he didn't realise how seriously he'd injured his father. Is that a possibility, Mr. Beasley?
Yes, your lordship.
Then can we move this along, Mr. Rumpole? Is that too much to ask?
Rumpole, the judge is against us.
Good. We'll make the jury realise he's being unfair and get a sympathy verdict.
The jury didn't look very sympathetic as they listened to the next witness. Mrs. Beasley told the court all about the delicious dinner she'd served to Michael Skelton and his father. Roast beef, with all the trimmings, followed by her speciality, treacle tart with cream. But she'd left the dining room quickly, she said, when an argument became heated.
It was all about Michael's poetry to begin with. Mr. Skelton told his son he could never survive by writing anything, and he should finish his medical course or he wouldn't get another penny. And then Michael shouted, "I've got a whole long life to lead, but you're going to die very soon." Well, that's when I left the room.
Rumpole had a chance to cross-examine Mrs. Beasley, but he barely asked her a single question.
No further questions.
Danny looked quite upset about this. He leant over and touched my arm as he whispered in my ear...
Hilda, why hasn't Rumpole challenged the statement about Michael shouting at his father? It's the strongest evidence against us. What's wrong with your husband?
I don't know, Danny. I'm sorry. Whatever Rumpole's plan was, and I wasn't sure he actually had a plan, he seemed to enjoy himself with the forensic evidence. Michael Skelton had his father's blood all over his hands, shirt cuffs, one of his sleeves, and on the head of the golf club he'd been holding.
Perhaps the blood got there when
Rumpole tried to suggest that the blood got on his clothes when Michael knelt down to examine his father's wounds. But the judge quickly intervened.
I thought your client didn't want to be a doctor, Mr. Rumpole. Why would he have been anxious to examine anyone's wounds?
Perhaps sensing that Mr. Justice Graves was agin the defence, Claude Erskine Brown decided to push his luck and, at the end of the day, asked to raise a matter in the absence of the jury.
My lord, it seems the defence has filed an alibi notice stating that Michael Skelton was in the woods reading a poem he had written to some Romany gypsies. However, Mr. Rumpole has failed to give the prosecution the names of the witnesses they intend to call to support the so-called alibi.
Well, Mr. Rumpole, why has the defence refused to supply those names?
Simply because we haven't yet traced the relevant witnesses, my lord.
What steps have you taken?
We have advertised, my lord, in several publications, I believe. Perhaps his lordship would like to see the notice.
Daniel, can we show the judge a copy of the advert?
I'm afraid we can't.
Why ever not?
The advertisement was overlooked by Mr. Turnbull. He sends his apologies.
I'm waiting, Mr. Rumpole.
I don't want Turnbull's apologies. I want an advertisement. I want witnesses. This is a bloody murder case. Quite literally.
Mr. Rumpole!
My lord, a slight complication, I'm afraid. I wonder if his lordship might be minded to grant an adjournment. Gah! Ugh.
His lordship was, of course, not minded to grant Rumpole anything. Danny and I left Rumpole to explain the rather hopeless situation to young Michael, and we adjourned to the hotel dining room.
I'm seriously worried about your husband, Hilda.
Why?
Because he got on the wrong side of the judge from the word go, and the jury don't like the way he's handling the case. Do you honestly think he wants to win?
Well, he wants to win every case he does, but he's cross, very cross.
Because?
The advertisements. Did you see his face when you told him they'd been forgotten?
That was Turnbull's fault. Mm. I can't check every tiny detail. Will you do something for me, Hilda?
That depends what it is.
Keep an eye on Rumpole. Now he's so cross with me, he may not tell me everything he's got in mind for the defence. So, if he's planning to take any sort of peculiar line, if he gets any strange ideas, will you please let me know?
Well, I suppose I could do that. Yes.
Thank you, dear Hilda. You really are.
Good evening.
Rumpole!
I hope you don't mind. We've started without you.
Yes, apparently you have.
We're both having soup.
I was just down the cells with Michael. No soup for him tonight. Some stale bread and water, I expect.
I don't suppose you've learnt anything new.
As a matter of fact, I did. Something he hadn't had the sense to tell us before, silly boy that he is. He gave me the name of a doctor.
What doctor?
A fellow called Christy Vickers. Runs a practice in Upper Wimpole Street. Now, according to Michael, Dr. Christy Vickers saw his father a couple of weeks before they quarrelled and diagnosed an aggressive type of prostate cancer. That's why, Michael said, his father was going to die very soon.
Why on earth didn't Michael mention this before?
I agree it's peculiar, but the boy himself is odd. Perhaps he's only just realised the trouble he's in.
You want me to find this doctor?
As soon as possible, obviously.
I'll use the telephone in reception. Do carry on without me.
Danny's worried about the way you're handling this case.
Danny? Why do you call him Danny?
Doesn't everyone?
I don't. He's rapidly becoming my least favourite person.
Oh, but why?
The business with the advertisement, for one thing.
Oh, that wasn't Danny's... Mr. Newcomb's fault. He wants to win this case as much as you do. You do want to win, Rumpole.
Am I in the habit of losing cases?
It has been known. And you have to admit that things are looking bad for your client. Mr. Newcomb says it's obvious he did it for the money. Even if you lose and Michael Skelton goes away for 10 years, he'll still come out and collect £200,000.
Did Newcomb tell you that? If so, he's an idiot.
Rumpole.
Any fool knows that a murderer can't profit as a result of his crime. If Michael's found guilty, he won't be able to benefit from his father's estate. Newcomb must know that.
Did Michael know?
He said he did.
Then he must be an idiot.
Well, he's not. Got a scholarship to King's College London.
And yet he committed a murder in a way that was almost certain to be discovered. Hanging about by the corpse, clutching a blood-stained golf club, knowing full well he wouldn't get the money from his father's will. I mean, does that really make sense?
Hilda?
Rumpole?
I don't know how you've managed it, but you seem to have hit on a better argument against my client's guilt than a little queasiness at the sight of blood.
Have I?
Yes. Yes, thank you, Hilda. Is there anything else you'd like to tell me?
Sorry.
Sorry. I found the doctor's number, but he didn't answer. I'll try again first thing in the morning. What are we talking about?
Rumpole was just...
I was just trying to decide between the fish and the lamb. I think I'll opt for the lamb. And perhaps a bottle of red.
Waiter!
I left the men in the bar and took myself to bed. I fell asleep before Rumpole joined me in the bedroom, and he was up bright and early the next day, so I didn't see him before the police began to give evidence.
I swear by mighty God that the evidence I shall give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I say, Rumpole.
I am PC Reginald Cummings.
Just trying to find Dr. Christy Vickers again. Seems he's driving through France on holiday. Don't know if we'll ever get hold of the chap. Sorry.
I see. Well, keep trying, will you?
Of course.
The police evidence was very boring, and I found myself flicking through a file of photographs, mainly to keep myself awake. Luckily, there were no pictures of the dead victim, but there were a couple of Dimitri Skelton when he was still alive. And what a handsome man he'd been, before having his facial features rearranged with a nine-iron. I yawned a little, then looked up to the ceiling of the courtroom. The public gallery was quite full, but there, standing in a doorway at the back of it, was Dimitri Skelton, the murdered man himself. I swear I saw him clearly. There were no head wounds. In fact, he looked remarkably well and suntanned, as though, since his death, he'd found time for a Caribbean holiday. Danny must have seen Dimitri as well. He suddenly leapt to his feet and, with a quick bow to the judge, hurried out of the courtroom. After just a few seconds, he reappeared in the doorway of the public gallery, and I watched as he whispered urgently to the ghost of his client's dead victim. What on earth was going on? There was only one way to find out, and I quickly left the courtroom myself. I was just in time to see the back of Danny as he spoke quietly to Dimitri.
I told you to stay away. I told you to go back down under and never come near me again. Now, come on, let's get you out of here.
They left the building quickly, and I followed, pausing at the main entrance to watch as Dimitri got into a car and, with Danny checking that no one in the car park was taking an interest, the ghost drove away at speed. I was close enough to see a sign in the back window of the car, Rudyard's Car Rental.
Wow.
And I even spotted a few letters on the number plate. A-R-B. At that moment, I had stopped being a discontented housewife with longings for a newer world. At that moment, I had become a lawyer, or at least a detective. But I knew Rumpole would merely patronise me if I told him what I'd seen.
I think...
As for Danny... Well, I wasn't sure what he was up to anymore.
Would you like some treacle tart, Mrs. Rumpole?
Oh, yes, please, Mrs. Beasley.
Oh, I'm afraid your husband's got his work cut out in this horrible case. Here's your tart.
Oh, thank you. That's absolutely delicious. You really are an excellent cook.
That's not what I was told by Miss Ashton.
Miss Ashton?
Elizabeth Ashton, Mr. Skelton's secretary. Kept coming into my kitchen telling me how to bake, how to roast. She thought she knew best about everything. Still, that's Australians for you.
Was she from Australia?
They're all big heads down under. Mr. Skelton's got a cousin, Ivan, who moved there a couple of years ago. It was Ivan who recommended Miss Ashton for the secretarial job.
And did you ever meet this Ivan?
Oh, no. But Mr. Skelton used to talk about him, and he showed me a couple of photos, spitting image of Mr. Skelton.
Spitting image? Really? How interesting.
Is it?
I might even tell my husband.
Will you tell him something else?
What's that, Mrs. Beasley?
Well, it's just that Mr. Beasley He didn't see all of the film that night. Mm-hmm. Near the end, he slipped upstairs to the toilet and he looked out the window. Mm-hmm. In the yard, there was a car with its lights on. Mr. Beasley thought the battery might run flat if it was left there all night. Anyway, he told me the number plate was just right for him because it had his initials at the start. Albert Raymond Beasley.
ARB.
That's it. We told Mr. Newcomb about the car, but he said it was nothing to do with the murder and we should just forget it. But I couldn't. Do you think it's important, Mrs. Rumpole?
Yes, Mrs. Beasley. I think it might be extremely important. Any chance of some more treacle tart?
Oh.
After one more slice, I hurried back to the hotel and found Rumpole, where else, in the bar.
Hilda, there you are. Feeling better?
Much better now I've got you a decent defence.
Got me a what?
Buy me a gin and tonic and I'll explain. It was the most serious, enjoyable conversation we'd had for a long time. And when we'd finished...
I suppose you realise what this means.
For Michael Skelton?
For your friend, Danny Newcomb.
Yes, I realise what it means.
Hmm. You don't mind?
No. I don't think I mind one tiny little bit. The next morning, after Rumpole had left the hotel to visit Michael in his cell, I had a luxurious bath. And I took my place in court. Sitting there, I realised that for the last few months, ever since that dinner in the Sheridan, I'd been nervous, strung up, and even if I say so myself, rather silly. When Danny sat next to me on the defence bench, I felt absolutely nothing.
Are we going to have the pleasure of your company in court again, Hilda?
If you think it's a pleasure, yes.
You must have thought it rather strange when I suddenly bolted out yesterday.
Did you bolt out? I didn't notice.
I thought I saw someone I knew in the public gallery. I was wrong. It was nobody.
I see.
I'm afraid there's not much hope now for poor Michael.
Oh, you never know what Rumpole's going to pull out of the bag.
Ah, you mean you know what he's going to pull out. You promised me you'd tell me if he had one of his funny ideas.
I'm afraid I'm not going to keep my promise.
Why ever not?
Because I don't think Rumpole would like it. Oh, and I have to tell you this, Mr. Newcomb. It's far too late to seek a newer world.
He looked shocked, but not half as shocked as he did a little later in the day when Rumpole got going.
Members of the jury, my next witness will be my instructing solicitor, Mr. Daniel Newcomb.
Rumpole, you're not calling me.
That's the general idea. Will you step into the witness box, please?
Come along. We haven't got all day, Mr. Newcomb.
Danny walked as grimly as a soldier crossing a minefield.
I swear by Almighty God that the evidence I shall give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Mr. Newcomb, you are familiar with the late Dimitri Skelton's will.
I should be. I drafted it.
He drafted it, Mr. Rumpole.
I'm aware of that, my lord. Now, in the event of this jury finding my client guilty, he won't be able to inherit anything under his father's will he?
We all know that, Mr. Rumpole. A murderer cannot profit from his crime.
Exactly, my lord. I do so congratulate your lordship. You have put your finger upon the nub, the very heart of this case. Oh. Now, who is to benefit if my client is found guilty of murder?
Well, Elizabeth Ashton would still get a £10,000 legacy.
Remind us, please, Elizabeth Ashton was Dimitri Skelton's secretary, was she not?
That's correct.
And the residue of the estate?
That would all go to the deceased cousin in Australia, Mr. Ivan Skelton.
About £200,000, is it not?
Something like that, yes.
Lucky old Ivan.
Mr. Rumpole.
Of course, if Michael Skelton is acquitted, Ivan doesn't get a penny.
So, Ivan must be praying for a guilty verdict, mustn't he? This jury comes back and says, guilty, my lord, Bingo! The old darling's worth 200,000. So I imagine Ivan Skelton's taking a considerable interest in the outcome of this case.
I imagine he is concerned about it, yes.
You've met Ivan Skelton?
Don't lead, Rumpel.
Now, forgive me, Erskine Brown. Mr. Newcombe, have you ever met Mr. Ivor Skelton?
I met him when he came to England a few months ago, yes.
What does he look like?
Look like? He's a little difficult to describe.
Doesn't he look exactly like the man in this photograph? Can you see? From over there? Yep. This photograph is actually of the dead man, Dimitri, but his cousin, Ivan, looks identical, does he not?
They're about the same age, and there is, I suppose, a family resemblance.
Thank you.
Is that all, Mr. Rumpole?
Not quite, my lord. Mr. Newcombe, you are the trusted family solicitor.
I am trusted, and I am the family solicitor.
So you are what I say you are, and this secretary, Miss Elizabeth Ashton, she comes from Australia, does she not?
I believe so.
And she is engaged to be married to Ivan Skelton. So he recommended her to his cousin Dimitri, who gave her employment. They all expected Ivan to come over to this country later in the year to marry Elizabeth Ashton. Is that your understanding?
It is.
But despite being engaged to the cousin, she became the mistress of Dimitri.
Mr. Rumpole, I do wonder what this has to do with the charge against your client.
Then wonder on, my lord, till truth makes all things plain. Mr. Newcombe, when did you last see Ivan Skelton?
I can't remember.
No, come now, your memory's not quite as short as all that. There are others in court who can answer my question if you really feel unable to.
Very well, I think I saw him yesterday.
Where?
In court. Here, in the public gallery.
No doubt he was anxious to see if he was going to get his money. And you spoke to him?
Yes.
What did you say?
My lord, that's pure hearsay.
Yes, Mr. Erskine Brown, it certainly is.
Of course it is, my lord. One can always trust your lordship with his great experience to be right on a point of law. Mr. Newcombe, I advised your firm to advertise for gypsy witnesses, but you failed to do so.
I am afraid it was overlooked, yes.
You declared that Dimitri Skelton's doctor could not be found, and yet he was found quite easily without your help.
I'm very glad to hear it.
Are you, Mr. Newcombe? Are you also glad that I shall be calling Mr. Beasley to say that a strange car was parked in the yard at Longacre on the night of the murder? Did you tell him that this evidence was irrelevant?
My lord, Mr. Rumpole is cross-examining his own witness.
Not at all. At the moment, I'm making no attack on Mr. Newcombe. He may genuinely have thought that the presence of a car hired by the murdered man's cousin was of no interest to the court.
I may have said something...
Stop there, Mr. Newcombe. Mr. Rumpole, I have to agree with Mr. Erskine Brown.
Surprise, surprise.
Your questions are an attack on your own witness. It is quite improper.
Then let me ask a quite proper question. Mr. Newcombe, have you been offered a share of Ivan Skelton's winnings to make sure that this young man who stands before us in the dock is convicted of murder?
Mr. Rumpole, this cross-examination is going from bad to worse.
No, I quite agree with every word that has fallen from your lordship. We are dealing here with something very bad indeed.
Am I to understand that you are accusing your own solicitor of entering into a criminal conspiracy to get this young man falsely convicted of murder?
Your lordship puts the matter far more eloquently than I ever could. I'm sure it's that gift for words that brought your lordship such success at the bar.
Mr. Newcombe is entitled to refuse to answer a question likely to incriminate him, is he not?
Of course, as always, your lordship is perfectly correct.
Then I fully intend to warn him.
Your lordship can take no other course.
And so the judge warned Danny.
I must warn you.
And Danny decided to answer no more questions from Rumpole, who gave the jury a look that seemed to say, make of that what you will.
Very well, my lord.
Danny hurried out of court, and I never saw him again. But I gave him not one thought as I listened to Rumpole's final speech to the members of the jury, who were very much on his side by now.
A young man is walking in the woods, making up poetry, when one of Rudyard's rental cars drives up to Longacre. Out of it gets Mr. Ivan Skelton from Australia. He's there because he's heard of the love affair between his cousin Dimitri and his fiancée, Elizabeth Ashton. Nobody witnessed the quarrel that followed. Mr. and Mrs. Beasley were watching a noisy war film, and the house was empty. Overcome with rage and jealousy, Ivan struck Dimitri with a golf club again and again and again. No one saw Ivan after that fight or gave evidence about the bloodstains on him. But when young Michael came home and found his father dead and was stained by his father's blood as he knelt beside the body, was it not natural that he should be suspected? And how very convenient for Ivan that he was, because if Michael was convicted, Ivan would inherit a fortune. And remember, he was here with us the other day, members of the jury, the man you might think is possibly, even probably, guilty. That man was in the public gallery making sure his inheritance was safe. And then, when he had been warned by my solicitor, did he not slink away in his hired car to await the news of the young poet's wrongful conviction? If you think that's what may have happened, members of the jury, let us deny Ivan Skelton his final satisfaction and his undeserved wealth. Let us find young Michael Skelton not guilty of the terrible crime of murdering his father. And remember, it is your decision, and not, as his lordship will agree, not the decision of anyone else in this court.
Cheers.
Are we still celebrating your success in R.V. Skelton?
Our success, Hilda. Some of your ideas were surprisingly helpful.
Well, I have to say, you failed to follow up some fairly obvious clues until I got on the case.
I was distracted. I thought you might have grown tired of life here with me.
For what is wedlock, forced, but a hell? An age of discord and continual strife, whereas
the contrary bringeth bliss and is a pattern of celestial peace.
Henry the Sixth, Act 5, Scene 5.
What was all that about Newcombe taking a shine to you?
I was wrong. He wanted me to spy on you, Rumpole. Tell him if you were getting too near the truth in R.V. Skelton. And he only gave you the case because you're not a QC.
I don't understand.
He thought you wouldn't do the job properly.
That's ridiculous.
Of course it is. You did the job with exceptional skill, Rumpole. You should feel very proud of yourself.
Do I regret what happened... almost happened with Daniel Newcombe? Well, if thou rememberest not the slightest folly that ever love did make thee run into, thou hast not loved. As You Like It. Act 2, Scene 4.
In Rumpole and Hilda by John Mortimer, Horace Rumpole was played by Julian Rhine-Tutt. Hilda, Jasmine Hyde. And Daniel Newcombe was Stuart McCrory. Claude Erskine Brown was played by Nigel Anthony. Judge Graves, Stephen Critchlow. And Mrs. Beasley was Cathy Sarah. Other parts were played by members of the company. Rumpole and Hilda was adapted by Richard Stoneman, directed by Marilyn Imrie, and is a Catherine Bailey production for BBC Radio 4. And Rumpole.